Pythagoras, it's often said, knew well what these mysterious bodies were, 2,000 years before anything resembling the modern science of paleontology had begun shuffling out of the shadows. But, Pythagorean foresight aside, the world had long been steeped in a degree of ignorance that seems barely credible today. Until the beginning of the 18th century, the objects found inside rocks were known not as fossils. That word had a much more general usage, meaning anything, minerals and crystals included, that had been dug up from the ground. Any item that had been unearthed or discovered lying in a field and that had the look of an animal or a plant about it, an obvious shell, say, or a sea urchin, a leaf or a piece of branch, was known, cumbrously, though perhaps quite reasonably, as a figured stone. A few of these stones were easy to explain. Some, like those that happened to have a shape vaguely resembling a human head or a carrot or a ship, could almost certainly have been shaped accidentally. Tree limbs or animal bones that had never been mineralized and that were merely stuck in mud or in the sand by a riverbed were obviously pieces of modern organic life which had died and become mired in the earth. The figured stones that interested and amazed people in the 17th century, and people, aristocrats and members of the leisured classes especially, amassed enormous collections of them, with both the Royal Society and Oxford's Ashmolean Museum housing them in handsome display cases, were those that were clearly made of mineral material. These were thus definable as stones, and yet they looked uncannily like something that had once been living, or else they mimicked the aforesaid shells, sea urchins, leaves, or pieces of branch. They obviously couldn't possibly be such things, that went without saying. To suggest otherwise was either to court ridicule, a once-living shell thrust halfway up a mountain indeed, or else to be accused of apostasy or heresy for tinkering with the ordered faiths of nature. But to gaze at them in astonished rapture, this is what the nobly born of England did 3 centuries ago, much as later generations gazed in awe at mounted specimens of the coelacanth, or at specimens of rock from the surface of the moon. No, such things, so awesome and wondrous to behold, could only be explained in one way. Clearly they were unique creations of the Almighty himself. Lapides sui generis is the phrase now employed, stones unto themselves. They existed for one reason only, and that was to reinforce in humankind's collective mind the omnipotence and imaginative beneficence of God. He placed the figured stones where they were discovered, using to do so what was termed a vis plastica, a plastic force. He used the force to insert into rocks miraculously perfect simulacra of living things, for the sole purpose of reminding the entire human race that God did indeed move in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. And there, to the enraptured viewers of the stones, was an end to it. The science that was needed to justify such a belief to sceptics was simple enough. This, after all, was still the time of phlogiston and the ether, and the firmly held belief that mountains grew like trees organically, upward and outward. To anyone who imagined such a thing, it didn't require too much of a leap of imaginative faith to conclude that mysterious stone objects found in the earth were there either because A, they had been infused on heaven's command with some kind of petrifying fluid, B, they had had their nature changed by a kind of juice that emanated from nearby mineral seams, or C, that the stars had exerted some kind of magnetic or gravitational influence on them from the heavens. And if all these theories failed the rigorous tests of observation, then one could always simply resort to D, the mysterious ways of God. Collectors would argue that a divine virtue was behind the placing of all fossils, using the word virtue in the old sense, rare now, meaning by way of supernatural power. Old-fashioned scientific explanation appealed most of all, especially to those who, in post-Restoration England, were trying to make some order out of the chaos they perceived in the world. To the scientists, the idea that a stone might grow into the shape of a sea urchin was surely not outlandish at all. If a perfectly symmetrical crystal could grow out of apparently nothing, if a mysterious process of chemistry could make a stalactite or a kidney stone or a coral, a rock that grows after all, then why couldn't the same kind of inexplicable and enigmatic natural force make a stone that looked like a shell or a tree, or, as in the case of the Oxfordshire poundstones, in the shape of a hedgehog, and do so, moreover, deep within the body of a rock? However, there was more to it than this. Even if the theoretical processes behind the formation of such figured stones were correctly guessed by these 17th-century philosophers, there was a host of additional unanswered questions. How did these figured stones get to all the places where they were found? Why did some kinds of rocks, those in the wild moors of Devon or in the mountains of North Wales or the high hills of Shropshire, have almost no such stones buried within them, while other kinds of rock, such as those that made the hills of Devon or were to be found in the quarries of Oxfordshire or the coalfields of Northumberland, possessed of them in enormous numbers? Why, as an early naturalist named John Rothmel noticed in the 1730s, did most of these curious figured stones crop up inside those rocks that were to be found in a rough line that stretched in a northeasterly direction clear across England, from the cliffs of Dorset and via the Cotswold Hills in the south, up through Leicestershire to Yorkshire and the great cliffs in the coast near Whitby? And as a corollary to this thought, if God was behind their distribution, why were the stones not left scattered around everywhere, to be found uniformly and randomly, like the stars in the heavens? It had been towards the end of the 17th century that the first very few and very bold observers raised, albeit timidly, the ultimate heretical thought, the possibility that perhaps, just perhaps, these objects actually were what collectors and scientists and countrymen had long been loath to consider admitting, that they were the organic remains of the very creatures that they looked like. It was men, for instance, like Nicholas Steno, a Dane, and Robert Hooke, a Briton, who blazed this particular trail. To them, the unsayable became the irrefutable. These fossil stones, they were certain, had indeed once been living creatures. Hooke argued the case particularly logically and meticulously. He identified three stages that could be witnessed on all sides, which he said demonstrated the three stages in the formation of a typical fossil. In the first stage, wholly unpetrified bones, shells, and vegetable remains were to be found in beds of mud and peat and moss. The rock around them was unformed, the fossils within them still almost as organic as when they'd been alive. Then, second, in lignites and brown coals, the sedimentary beds that weren't properly rocks, but were slightly more solid and consolidated than mud and peat, in them there were bones, shells, and parts of trees and leaves that had somehow been changed. These specimens, which by now could perhaps formally be called fossils, had been half-petrified. In their present-day resting place, inside layers of half-formed rock, they too were half-formed, being neither wholly organic as when they were alive, nor yet wholly stone. In the next and third stage, they would become so. In layers of coal, a fully consolidated rock, though born from peat and lignite in turn, Hooke noted that there were leaf, tree, and other shell-like remains to be found that were as wholly coal-like, coal-coloured, and self-evidently coal, as coal was itself. Could it perhaps be, he wondered, that great pressure, great heat, or complex physico-chemical reactions had transformed the once organic remains into minerals, just as the mud had been transformed into peat, the peat into lignite, and the lignite into the solid black rock mineral that we called coal? Could not a slow and uniform process, which had been so visible in the making of coal itself, work its mysterious magic on the life forms that had been present at the origin, turn them into stone, and make them into fossils? Most scientists of the time still dismissed such ideas as laughable. What event, they asked tangentially, could possibly have swept these remains to where they were now found? Could Noah's great flood, which was then implicitly and almost universally believed, as it would be for the better part of another century, could it have been so violent and so massive as to wash shells up onto the mountain tops, where, it had to be admitted, they had been found? Could these creatures have been swept onto the land at the moment of creation? No to both, said the seers of the day. Noah's flood was said in Genesis to have been a short and placid affair, and as for creation, since it was widely accepted that the land was created before life, it would be impossible for any organic remains to be infiltrated deep inside the newly created rocks, because there was no life in existence to be so inserted. In addition, it hadn't escaped the notice of some collectors that many of the figured stones they found represented animals and plants that didn't seem currently to exist. This suggested, in other words, that if indeed the stones were relics, they were relics of living creatures that were no longer around and had since become extinct. Since extinction was an impossible, unthinkable event in any divinely created cosmos, then this notion too was invalid, inappropriate, and wholly wrong. And yet, as the 18th century opened, so these long-held beliefs and prejudices were confronted with increasing vigour by counter-argument, by solidly mounted challenges to the dogmas and received wisdoms and ecclesiastical imperatives of old, and most important, by evidence. The ideas of Steno and Hooke, however hostile their initial reception by the Church, however flaccid their initial acceptance by the public, began slowly to take root. At about the same time, there came a vague, inexpressibly gossamer fragile thought that there might be some kind of link between two of the concepts that were an implicit part of the fossil collector's system of belief. People began to wonder if these stones might actually be the relics of living things, and placed where they were found by no less an agency than what they liked to call the Noachian deluge, Noah's flood. Perhaps somehow the flood could be implicated in shifting these objects, even to where they now existed in the rocks of high mountain ranges and on the Oxfordshire meadows. Perhaps somehow this same flood could also be implicated in the process that created the objects in the first place. Perhaps the rocks and all that lay inside them, the Chedworth buns, the pundibs, the oyster shells, the fern leaves and the crystal corals, fish skulls and lizard bones, had all somehow been precipitated, or had crystallized themselves from the fluid of a universal flood-created sea. Perhaps, if such things were demonstrably true, then maybe, just maybe, the matter of intense puzzlement that had already confused untold generations of naturalists, what were fossils, and why were they found where they were, might be solved. The flood, in short, was to be the 18th century answer to everything. Noah was now the key. Half a century before 1769, when William Smith was born, the notion that figured stones were just inorganic and petrified replicas cunningly inserted inside rocks to prove the omnipotent genius of God had been at last abandoned, conveniently forgotten, regarded, if at all, as a distant cosmic joke. A more modern and more reasonable science was on its way to being forged. And if today the long survival of ideas about the flood, which must have coloured and tainted the thinking of such an 18th-century observer as the young William Smith, seem more than a little ludicrous, then at least Smith was brought up free from having to believe that his pound stones and his pundibs were just minerals. He knew, as the thinking world was then coming to accept, that echinoids and pterobratulids were not minerals at all, but, as Steno and Hooke had taught, had once been animals. So even though William Smith was brought up in a society still in the firm grip of purblind churchly certainty, his scientific training, such as it was, allowed for a measure of liberality. James Ussher was still there on the margins to confuse. To deny his beliefs was to risk being branded a heretic. But in the later decades of the 18th century, it was also possible, and moreover acceptable, for a thinking student to suppose that life, far older than humankind, and perhaps far stranger than humankind could imagine, might once have existed on the planet. The corollary to such thinking was that the Earth must in turn be far, far older than James Ussher had ever supposed. That, for the time being, had to remain unsaid. But that it could be thought, and that there was evidence to prove it, was for the young Oxfordshire man a liberating realization. Realization that helped in no uncertain manner to foster the new science that he was soon, and at first almost unwittingly, to help establish. The Duke and the Baronet's Widow. "A fully equipped English duke," grumbled Lloyd George to what he knew would be a sympathetic, working-class Edwardian audience on Tyneside, "cost as much as 2 dreadnoughts, was every bit as great a terror, and lasted a great deal longer." Which was not, it has to be said, an exact description of the third Duke of Bridgewater. Francis Egerton, who was born in 1736, succeeded to the title when he was only 12, gave much of his money and his collections to the government, and allowed the dukedom to die with him in 1803. He was a startling exception to Lloyd George's general argument, in other words. This particular dukedom of Bridgewater cost precious little and lasted almost no time at all. And yet, in one sense, the Prime Minister was right, for Bridgewater was very much a terror, in many ways, seen from today's perspective, a quite appalling man. As a child he had been thought so stupid that his father, who was called Scroope, seriously considered making a codicil to his will to ensure that the boy, the second son, could never ever succeed to the title. But the sudden and premature death of Scroope's oldest son scuppered that plan, and the child Francis, who had become a duke variously regarded as ignorant, awkward, and unruly, duly joined his fellow aristocrats in the House of Lords in 1748. He was at first widely disliked. As a young man he was irredeemably Philistine, with little regard for art or society. He dressed intolerably badly. He loathed flowers and all kinds of ornamentation. He smoked like industrial Manchester, consumed pounds of snuff, never wrote letters, and had arguments with everyone. Though in time he became a great collector of painting and sculpture, more for their value than their beauty, critics sneered, he wasted little time on what he regarded as the fripperies of life. He was a curmudgeonly bachelor and a misogynist who so despised women that he wouldn't even allow one to serve him at table. He had only 2 apparent interests, the racing and riding of horses, and, most significantly for this story, the building of canals. It was a fascination that became an obsession, both for the Duke and for his country. Canal mania, the national mood was called, and it was all begun by this strangely unpleasant man. In 1759, the Duke of Bridgewater had completed a 42-mile stretch of artificial waterway, complete with locks, that allowed him to ship coal from his own mines at Worsley in Lancashire directly into the heart of Manchester and then onward to the River Mersey. Since most of the price of coal was the cost of transporting it across country, the use of a canal slashed prices by as much as 50%. Smelling the prospect of limitless profits, every investor with spare change promptly jumped onto what seemed an unstoppable bandwagon. Every bank, every entrepreneur, every developer, every engineer in England suddenly seemed to believe that the canal was the highway of the future. The owners of the turnpike roads howled their dismay. Farmers, angry that their land would be torn up, raised all manner of objections. But, one by one, Parliament passed canal acts and navigation acts at a staggering rate. Small armies of navvies, workers on the inland navigation, so-called, descended onto the hills and valleys to carve and cement these revolutionary new trade routes into place. Grand plans were conceived for connecting the whole country, Carlisle to Cornwall, Dover to Dumfries, with a network of waterways. The great existing trade rivers of England, the Thames, the Severn, the Mersey and the Trent, were all to be linked. Maybe, one over-ambitious inventor suggested, the English Midlands could have their own canal that followed the contour lines, and so didn't need the costly and cumbersome mechanism of locks. But since this canal would have been hundreds of miles long, requiring a horse to drag its barge the equivalent of a transatlantic crossing merely to go down to London, this plan was quietly dropped. Almost overnight, extraordinary economic miracles were realised. A brewer in Burton, who previously could reckon to be able to sell his ales within a radius of only 5 or 10 miles, found he could now load his barrels onto a horse-drawn canal boat and 2 days later have them delivered in London. No longer did Josiah Wedgwood have to hear how his fragile porcelains had been smashed to smithereens during their transit on the potholed public roads. Now they could pass along the waterways in the steady tranquillity of the floating world, and be safely in the shops of Liverpool and Oxford and Edinburgh in a matter of days. Exporters based in Birmingham no longer needed to route all their wares through agents in London. They could send their goods to the United States directly by canal boat from the factory straight to the clipper ships waiting at the Liverpool docks. And for the ordinary public, too, canals became immediate sources of betterment. No longer did coal double in price in the aftermath of heavy rains. Now it was always cheap, and except in times of thick, canal-choking ice, bad weather scarcely ever affected its price or the speed of its delivery again. The Duke was quite right to foresee that indeed in those early heady days the greatest canal cargo of all was to be coal. One horse plodding quietly along ahead of a fully laden coal barge could haul 80 times more than if it were leading a wagon down a muddy road, could take 400 times as much as a single pack horse. All of a sudden, anyone with a coal mine anywhere in England now wanted a canal, so that his anthracite and his steam coal could be carried quickly and cheaply to the furnaces of the Industrial Revolution. It has long been said that the people of England could never be poor, since they lived on an island made of coal and surrounded by fish. There had been an English coal mining industry of sorts, via shafts and adits and open-cut workings only, since the 13th century, though in fact the Romans had known of coal and had probably burned it. From 1325 there's a record suggesting that a British mine exported a boatload of the strange black material to Pontoise in northern France. At first the black and flammable stones were used mainly for iron smelting and lime burning. It was only in Tudor times, when the climate turned chillier and demand for wood for house-building soared, that people began to use coal to heat their homes. After that, there was no stopping it. Wherever in the country that coal was exposed on the surface, near Gateshead, close to Mansfield, outside Sheffield, in South Wales, near the Scottish town of Lanark, men clawed hungrily for it. It was convenient if coal remained close to the surface. It was easy to work and cheap. But it became so important a source of energy and heat that, by the 15th century, if a coal seam happened to plunge deep into the ground, then, discounting all risks in the name of profit, the men promptly dug after it. Coal miners were very limited at first. Their mines flooded, they collapsed, noxious gases poisoned workers or burst into flame. But then came technologies that allowed miners to dig deeper, to pursue seams for longer. And as a result, through the 17th and 18th centuries, the industry advanced at a prodigious rate. Chain pumps were brought in from Germany, and mines became drier. Thomas Newcomen invented the atmospheric engine, allowing pits to go deeper and allowing drowned mines to be pumped out and worked again. At around the time of Smith's birth, as we've already seen, James Watt came along with his condensing steam engine, and mines could be dug to reach seams 400 and 500 feet deep. And then again a decade later, once Watt's double-acting steam engine had been perfected and its rocking beams had been adapted to move huge iron wheels, so everything changed again. Air could now be pumped down to the miners, water could be pumped from where it gathered, elevators could be created that would speed workers down to the coal face and that would haul them and their coal back up to the surface again. In 1800, all Britain's coal mines, in which men were now working as deep as 1,000 feet below the surface, were producing 1 million tons of a variety of types of coal each year. Landowners realised that they possibly had, beneath their lawns and meadows and forests, huge seams of coal that could make them rich beyond their dreams. Everyone was suddenly on the lookout for dark rocks, for traces of blackness, for hints that somewhere below might be a load of that rich, soft, sweet-smelling substance that was for England what emeralds and silver and diamonds were elsewhere. Pits were dug and quarries were clawed, but often recklessly and cautiously, at every spot where the earth seemed to offer up its dark temptation. More often than not, the darkness was a chimera, a black shale, a slate, a mudstone, which had no more chance of burning than did granite. Failures dogged the diggings of all too many countrymen. Some sort of guide, some sort of a map was needed, a way for men to forecast with some accuracy just what might lie underneath them. Men had been mining coal in northern Somerset since the 13th century. There's a cryptic reference in Roman writings to a house in Bath having been heated by such stone locally mined. The Carboniferous coal measures that outcrop along the flanks of the Pennine Hills in northern England and in South Wales and southern Scotland outcrop around the Bristol Channel too. The same hot, dark swamps that eventually fossilised to produce coal existed south of Bath 300 million years ago, just as they existed near Durham, Leeds, Mansfield, Lanark, and the Rhondda Valley, and, since coal measures have been laid down all across Europe, just as they existed also in Silesia and Westphalia, in France and Belgium, and across the vast tracts of Russia. The conditions in which they were formed were, miraculously for Europe's economic development, much the same everywhere. There were fetid and swampy jungles, all mud, dead ferns and sagging branches of club mosses and horsetail. The steamy, clammy air was thick with clouds of insects, including dragonflies as big as thrushes. Scorpions and millipedes scurried and squirmed among the grasses and primitive leathery trees. Amphibians, from large, thick-headed, crocodile-like beasts to more gentle salamanders, splashed and lumbered through the steaming pools. But then, in a space of just a few hundred thousand years, and maybe less, the seas swished their way back. The trees and the plants and animals were overrun by salt water and drowned and died. Thin sands were laid down on top of all the dead vegetation, and then yet more limestone and shale and mudstone and marl formed, and pressed down on the organic mat below, until all was hot and heavy enough for the heating and compression to begin, heating and compression that would turn all of this thick, brown, decaying, gas-rich pulp into the hard black rock we know today as bituminous coal. In some places where the world of the era 300 million years ago was geologically stable, in Poland, say, in Westphalia, in northern England, the coal and the sandstones that alternated with one another were thick and fat and relatively undistorted by any later tectonic events. But in Somerset and the rest of southwestern England and Wales, matters were rather different. The layers of coal in the hills to the south of Bath have all been folded closely, complicatedly, and very differently from the coal layers that are found in the fields of Poland or Nottinghamshire. The Somerset coals have been squashed into small, tightly wound folds and are fractured by countless faults and fissures, making them difficult to find, tricky to mine, and costly to pry from under the earth. The crushing and twisting of the Somerset coal measures is evidence of part of one of the most dramatic events of more recent geological history. The rocks in this part of the world were all caught for millions of years in the gigantic vice of a cataclysmic mountain-building movement, one that occurred when the European and African tectonic plates of 300 million years ago moved sharply and catastrophically against one another. The grinding and squeezing and gnashing and crashing, basically the closing of a huge sea called the Rayic Ocean that had divided Europe and North America on the one hand, from Africa and South America on the other, went on for scores of millions of years, leading to the development of an entirely new supercontinent of the Permian period called Pangaea. The events, the vast rippling and crushing of the earth that so affected southwestern England, was once called the Hercynian Orogeny. Now, like much in modern geology, it has a new name, the Variscan Orogeny, and it's left a legacy of subterranean contortions and distortions that have greatly affected the appearance of all pre-Permian rocks of the region. It hasn't made too much of a difference to the scenery above. Few phenomena above the surface in Somerset would prompt anyone to imagine millions of years of crushing and grinding below. But what those years did to the underside of Somerset is truly awesome. There are coal seams down there, but they've almost all fallen victim to the contortions of mountain building. The fact that the beds of coal have been crushed and distorted out of all recognition has had a profound effect on the local economy. It hasn't stopped miners from trying to pry the coal from beneath the ground. Historically, very little dissuades miners from that. But it has affected mightily the way in which the miners have over the centuries tried to do the prying, and it's made the actual process of mining very difficult indeed. Coal that's difficult to obtain is priced accordingly, it's very expensive, and it was this simple fact that Somerset coal was so very costly to extract that led to the decision to build a canal. If it were costly to mine, but cheap to transport, Somerset coal might be competitive still. A canal, therefore, was essential to keep the coalfield in action at all. The fact that the tiny coalfield was wedged between two of the loveliest towns in southern England, Wells and Bath, was of little moment to the industrialists and profiteers who saw a chance to make money from the mineral fields below them. If this corner of rural England had to be made as charmless as Nottingham or County Durham, with the old stone villages defaced by winding gears and slag heaps, with the fields littered with cranes and coal barges, and the air thick with smoke and the cry of steam whistles, then so be it. The English economy was changing, and fast, and it was imperative that the revolution be allowed to percolate into the slow-dropping piece of Somerset for the good of all. For it was a rich coal field, and temptingly close to the big cities of the south, places like Bristol and Southampton, and even London, where huge numbers of customers were now living and scores of new factories were being built. The coalfield's backers believed it had potential. More than 100 tons of coal were already being torn from below northern Somerset in 1690, and when in 1763 a landowner named Lansdowne decided to bore an experimental shaft near his village of Radstock and found a sizable coal seam 500 feet down and another one 600 feet lower still, there occurred the beginnings of a coal rush. Suddenly, villages like Camerton, Foxcote, Timsbury, Rithlington and High Littleton, hitherto sleepy and forgotten places of wisteria-covered houses and fields with heavy-udded cows drowsing in the afternoon sun, became crowded with burly men in hard leather caps and black smocks, and the sound of hammering and pickaxing and the irregular thudding of Newcomen steam engines displaced the music of skylarks and church bells. It was a difficult coal field, too. Not only had the Variscan orogeny wrought havoc with the seams, some of them even plunged vertically downward, and could only be worked by the miners almost standing on one another's heads, but the roads in this part of Somerset were atrocious, thick with mud and as rough as the surface of the moon. John Wesley, the Methodist evangelist who once boasted that he regarded the whole world as his parish, found it difficult to include the North Somerset village of Midsummer Norton in his evangelical universe. It was so named, he wrote later, because the appalling local road conditions ensured it was only reachable in midsummer. And then in 1792, to make life even more difficult for the Somerset coal barons, Parliament was persuaded to pass the Monmouthshire Canal Act, which suddenly meant that South Wales coal, abundant and much simpler to work, could now become readily available on the Bristol market. This news resounded around Somerset like a death knell. The local collieries, it was feared, would be forced into ruin, unless the owners decided they also built a canal. If they could raise the funds and overcome the farmers' objections, then they could have Somerset coal floated swiftly and cheaply right into the heart of Bath. Perhaps, since another new canal was just then being planned to push deep into the southern heart of England to join the Thames, it could be barged right into the heart of London as well. And thus did canal mania come to cider country. By February the 1st, 1794, after a committee meeting at the White Hart Hotel in Bath to decide the route, deciding which collieries would be favoured and which ignored, a bill had been drafted and approved. By April the 17th, such was the anxiety of the promoters to beat off competition from the beastly Welsh, that Parliament had passed it and George III had signed it. The first excavators and the navvies then moved in a few weeks later, beginning the cutting, shovelling and concreting that would end in the making of 25 miles of perhaps the least remembered, and as it happened the soonest ruined, of the canals to be created during that curiously energetic period in British industrial history. The promoters who first decided the route of the canal took their lead from the man they quickly appointed as official surveyor to the project, an absurdly young apprentice lately arrived from Oxfordshire named William Smith. The young man had come on impressively in the years since he was playing marbles with Pundibs and marvelling at the intricate beauty of pound stones. He had done tolerably well at school, though, considering his family's poverty, there was no thought that he ever might go on to university. He had an apparent aptitude for geometry. He could draw more than adequately, and he had an evident fascination for the rocks among which he lived. His diary and his memoirs record his growing eagerness to understand what was going on beneath the green of the Oxfordshire meadowlands. There are entries, for example, recording how he found the whiteness of chalk extraordinary, and how he wondered why there were no stones in the Churchill fields on which he could sharpen a knife or from which he could strike a spark. Notes tell how he collected crystals of fool's gold, iron pyrite, that workmen had found when they were draining a great pond in the village of Sarsden, and that he had marvelled at how some farmers were using a local blue clay to colour their barn doors rather than wasting money on paint, and that he had stood for many minutes enraptured in front of the earth-cutting machines being used to make a road through the Chiltern Hills near Henley. And, unromantic though it may sound to the modern ear, he became fascinated by everything that had to do with drains, with drainage, natural springs, culverts, bogs, and pools, a fascination that's easier to understand if it's remembered that to farmers in central England, earth, sun, and water were all the core of their existence, quite proper subjects for their obsessive concern. By the time William Smith left school, he was something of a sophisticate, not least because, as well as having a developed rural knowledge, he had also travelled much farther than most young men from farms in rural Oxfordshire. He had gone, for instance, many times to London. He'd write later that he remembered especially sitting on a wooden seat on a cowhouse to watch criminals being hanged from the gibbet at Tyburn. He had been only too well aware of the scale of the terrible anti-Catholic Gordon riots in 1780. He'd experienced much of the Londoners' unparalleled joy when Admiral George Rodney returned there in triumph after routing the French fleet off Dominica. And he remembered the thick mud stalling the horse carts in what is now the eminently fashionable quarter of Manchester Square. His uncle, who, because of his name, was known by his nephew as Old William, seems to have treated him reasonably well, if somewhat parsimoniously. He was exasperated, it seems, with what he regarded as his nephew's effete habits, which by the time he was 17 had extended well beyond collecting brachiopods and echinoids, to carving sundials in slabs of another local rock, the oolitic limestone of the Middle Jurassic. Avuncular parsimony was nearly the boy's undoing. William found it difficult to afford books for his studies, and had to go so far as to ask his uncle for an advance against his will, and which was apparently given only grudgingly, for a few shillings to buy the volumes he needed. He had to travel to Oxford to make any serious purchases, the nearest town of any consequence. Chipping Norton had no bookshop, as Smith would later note, except for two shops that sold pots and pans, and which sold spelling books. One of the volumes he did manage to acquire, however, was particularly well worthwhile. It was The Art of Measuring, by a man named Daniel Fenning, and it was the book that introduced the young man to the skill that would become central to him for the rest of his adult life, the basic principles of surveying. And it was as he was carrying this book, walking down the single, sloping village street of Churchill, that he eventually met the man who would change his life. That man's name was Edward Webb, and he was a professional surveyor. His craft was all of a sudden big business in England. Roads were being built, country estates were being measured and laid out to gardens, canals were being dug, rivers improved, and common lands enclosed. It was the business of enclosure that had brought Edward Webb to Churchill. A group of the West Oxfordshire local squires and the wealthier farmers, just like their opposite numbers in countless other towns and villages up and down the country, had decided to have the local fields apportioned privately and farmed efficiently. A surveyor was needed, and Webb was brought over from Stow-on-the-Wold, 10 miles away. The young Smith introduced himself. In his own rather fanciful attempt at an autobiography penned many years later, he wrote that he met Webb entirely by chance, and asked him some penetrating questions about modern surveying practices. By the day's end, according to the diary that Smith was now in the habit of keeping, and which is today held in the library of the University Museum in Oxford, he had been hired to work as his assistant. This was the autumn of 1787. He was 18, and informally educated though he may have been, he now had a profession and a job. It took him only a few months to master the basic skills. By the following spring he had learned how to use the pantograph and the theodolite, the dividers and the great steel chain. By the early summer of 1788 he was entrusted with doing his own work, the first opportunity arriving when one of Webb's older assistants, who it was whispered drank, miscalculated the area of some allotments he had surveyed and made their owners order fences of the wrong size. William Smith did the measuring and the mensuration all over again, got everything right, and was promptly set up by Webb to survey other tracts of land on his own. He and Webb then began to travel together. Indeed, Webb and his family so liked the young man, they had him move away from Churchill and his niggardly uncle and into their substantial house at Stowe. From there, Smith travelled to a farm in Cricklade to make a survey of the Sapperton Canal Tunnel, to the Braden Forest, to the Kyneton Coalfield in Warwickshire. He also travelled to the New Forest, where he sank a borehole, looking for coal for the charcoal-burning industry, which was then locally booming. And by chance he also made brief but memorable contact with the one other celebrated former inhabitant of Churchill, the former Governor-General of India, Warren Hastings. For his entire career, Hastings, who had been born in Churchill, had yearned to return to his father's old estate at Dalesford in Worcestershire, which his father had been compelled to sell because of what were delicately but opaquely described as embarrassments arising out of the Civil War. That's the war between the 17th century's royalist and parliamentary armies, the Roundheads and the Cavaliers. With the £80,000 that he had brought back from his 34 years in India in 1785, Hastings eventually managed to buy the great house, though at the very time he completed the purchase he was embroiled in the notorious impeachment trial for alleged cruelty and corruption in Calcutta that was to last for 7 years, ruining him and, though he was eventually acquitted on all charges, forcing his retirement from public life. As soon as he bought the old family house and its 650 acres for £11,000, he decided that he needed the grounds landscaped. And in the spring of 1788, he called in the by now well-known surveyor Edward Webb from Stowe and his young partner apprentice, his Churchill-born former neighbour, William Smith. In his daybook, Smith records meeting Hastings, the gouty great man who sat on his horse with his livery servant behind him. The apprentice was rather harder on him than perhaps he needed to be. "Mr. Hastings," he wrote, "decided to be satisfied of my competency for the task, and so I had to sit down and draw him a sketch of what was intended. But in giving his instructions, I was surprised at his ignorance of the scale to which he requested his maps be enlarged." So, to add to the rigours of his trial before the House of Lords, the old Governor-General now had a young whippersnapper of a neighbour arching an eyebrow at his poor reading of maps. The trials of public life, he may well have reflected, can be great indeed. This was, in general, an important time for William Smith. His fondness for travel, for the life of a gypsy rover, seems to have begun in earnest during the late summer and autumn of 1788. And with it, to judge by his diaries, which are forever noting the presence of this rock here and that rock there, and the importance of this cliff or that valley, those rivers or that spring, a growing knowledge of and intimacy with the topography, and the wonder at what lay beneath it. He was no great diarist, but once in a while his entries make one wish he had been a better one. His travels and all that he saw during them would have produced, in more competent hands, a glorious portrait of country life in the late 18th century England. After crossing the naked hills from Stowe, joyously with the thoughts of being trusted to survey an estate myself, I saw from the edge of Broadway Hill what appeared to me one of the most glorious sights in the world, and I well remember standing some time to gaze over the immense extent of the rich country below. The day was fine, and the Vale of Evesham lay before me spread out like a map, the fruit trees and hedges being all whitened with the finest blossom that ever was known. I advanced into this rich country to survey an estate at Inkborough, in the midst of apple trees. In the year before, there had been a most abundant crop of fruit, so that cider was exceedingly plentiful. And by the blossoms, another stock of that cheering beverage might be expected, for which the growers feared they could not find stowage, their casks being then all full. But before long, these fears were dissipated, for the weather changed to wet and cold, the apples fell off before they had attained the size of walnuts, and the barley and other corn on the stiff lands I had to survey turned to yellow in the furrows and in all moist places. Most of the estate was upon the red marl, which in its redness astonished me more than any other kind of soil I had ever seen. He finally arrived in Somerset in 1791 on another mission from Edward Webb of Stowe. Here he was to make a valuation survey, on his own, of an estate in the pretty village of Stowey, that had recently been willed to a local grandee and coal-mine owner named Lady Elizabeth Jones. Characteristically, it being a warm and fine summer, the fares on the Trans-Cotswold post-chaise being higher than it seemed prudent to pay, and, since a trek of 50 miles seemed to Smith no more than a casual stroll, as it would to most hardened geologists even now, he decided to walk. He travelled along the roads the Romans built. After making southbound along the country roads, he struck southwest along the remains of Aikman Street first, which took him from Burford down to Cirencester, and then he turned on a more southerly route, via the Foss Way, to Tetbury and the old Roman settlement and pleasure drome of Bath. After that, keeping to the hills to the south and west around the Spa, he walked by way of Radstock, Odd Down, Stone Easton, and Temple Cloud, coalfield villages all, until finally he reached the vast acreages of the Jones estate. He was to remain in this part of England, at first working for his patron, and then later for the Somerset Coal Canal Company, for the next 8 years. 8 years during which he would make the discovery, come to the realization, announce the deduction, and begin the hard grind that would earn him his place in posterity. A Light in the Underworld. The village of High Littleton is a gritty, windy, hilly, and generally unlovely place, almost as far removed from the traditional imagery of Somerset. No cider apples, no jolly farmers, no thatch or maypole or cricket on the green, as if it were near Nottingham or on the country fringes of industrial Lancashire. Much the same might be said of the entire swathe of countryside that lies 10 miles to the south and southwest of Bath. It is pinioned between some of the loveliest and most measured architecture in all of southern England. Wells Cathedral, with its statues and gargoyles, is the spiritual and aesthetic mooring point to the west. The ordered, bewigged and precious life, the powdered and pomaded air of England's once second city, Regency Bath, wafts in from the east. But between lies an area that still today looks curiously out of place, architecturally, atmospherically, socially, commercially. It has smaller houses, meaner shops, grubbier streets, a spoiled and ragged landscape. All is a direct consequence of geology. These 50 square miles or so of Somerset, bounded by the red-brick villages of Clutton in the west and Coombe Hay in the east, Priston in the north and Kilmaston in the south, lie on top of a score of complex, broken, twisted and contorted seams of coal, which until the late as the 1970s were worked by as independent and militant a band of English mining men as might ever have stepped out from beneath the winding gears of the coalfields of Durham or Lanark. Maybe their militancy had arisen because of the unusual proximity in these parts of their class enemies. All around them, after all, were the great limestone houses and mannered city terraces occupied by soft-handed gentlemen farmers and sportsmen, philosophers and squires, artists and divines. There was no other local industry to provide brotherly support. In the 50 square miles of country that unrolled itself around where the 22-year-old William Smith came to live and work, the labouring classes were coal miners to a man. The mines were owned privately, usually by whoever owned the land under which the coal was first found. Of the Lady Jones, who first employed William Smith to landscape the estate around her house in Stowey, we know very little. But she and her late husband, Sir William Jones of Ramsbury, certainly owned a great deal of land other than the immediate neighbourhood of her house, which included both a large number of the neighbouring coal mines and a collection of farmhouses. It was into one of these, Rugbourne, which stood on the eastern outskirts of High Littleton, that she allowed her new young employee to move. Smith had good reason to remember this house vividly. It was, he wrote, a large old manor house, three-storied, solid, and four-square, sheltered by lime trees, and with a walled courtyard in front, and steps leading up to handsome gates and walls, now gone, that were thick enough to have a series of rounded niches in which Smith liked to sit and study his books. The house had once belonged to a Major Britton, who, the locals said, had ruined himself financially by working the coal seams that ran beneath the house. But when Smith moved in, it was occupied by a tenant farmer, Cornelius Harris, who gave him board and lodgings for half a guinea a week and took in his horse for an extra 10 shillings a month. He remembered the house not so much for its architecture, or its comforts, or the eminently reasonable price of the accommodations, however. He remembered it because of the work that he was to engage in, first in a mine less than a mile away to the north, and later in the canal that he was to help build a little further afield. It was a work of staggering significance. And because of it, Rugbourne Farm, High Littleton, deserves a memorial. The work that Smith undertook there, and the results that he achieved and pored over there, led ultimately to the creation of an entirely new science. For years afterwards, Smith looked back on his time at Rugbourne as the most important in his life, and the house as the crucible of the new discipline he believed himself to have created. The birthplace of geology, he later said grandly. But today there's no memorial, not a plaque on the house, nothing. Just an incorrectly dated sign erected by the local council back in the 30s at the entrance to a lane, pointing half-heartedly to where the house still stands. He worked there first for Lady Jones, surveying, planning, draining, in her capacity as director of the High Littleton Coal Company. But he was not without a greater ambition. A letter found in the files showed that he tried hard to persuade her to allow him to become a shareholder in one of her newer mines and to be its general manager. There's no record of a response. Instead, he was compelled to work at one of her older pits, which had first been excavated in 1783, and which was to have nearly 35 years of working existence. The mine was called the Mearns Pit, and though it was certainly one of the less familiar and less prosperous of the hundreds of mines and shafts that had been sunk over the centuries into the coal measures of North Somerset, its importance on the global stage is quite inestimable. For the Mearns Pit at High Littleton has a standing in the history of geology that is comparable to the one that Gregor Mendel's Moravian Pea Garden has in the science of genetics, the Galapagos Islands in evolutionary theory, and the University of Chicago football stadium in the story of nuclear fission. Yet this Somerset coal mine also goes unremembered today, just like Rugbourne Farm. There's no blue plaque, no brass plate, nothing. Just a small lump in a field that marks a scarified hillock of grassed-over mining waste, a mound that Somerset people still call a batch. And a scrap of paper in the University Museum in Oxford, recording what William Smith saw, felt, thought, and concluded when first he ventured into the dripping darkness of that dreary little West Country colliery. To describe exactly what Smith did at Mearns and why his working and thinking there marked the beginnings of something important, we now have to descend, rather like a miner nervously waiting his turn beneath the winding gear, into the half-illuminated and technically tricky gloom of the scientific underworld. The rocks that contain winnable coal in North Somerset belong to what are known, perhaps not surprisingly, as the upper, middle, and lower coal measures. The rocks that belong to this period were deposited during what in today's Britain is called the Westphalian stage of the upper Carboniferous period, which in turn is classified as having occurred over a period of about 20 million years during the closing millennia, the upper end, in other words, of that immensely long chunk of geologic time, an era in the vernacular, known as the Paleozoic. Modern radiometric dating shows that the coal measures were laid down between 310 and 290 million years ago. The world had by this time already seen and welcomed the appearance of such living complexities as ferns, sharks, and winged insects. It already disposed, by extinction, of less complex life forms such as stromatolites and graptolites. Before the end of the Upper Carboniferous, it was also about to do away with that most attractively lovable lobster-like Paleozoic arthropod known as the trilobite. None of this, neither the names of the geological eras, nor the age of the rocks, nor the existence of a fraction of the life forms within them, was known to Smith or to anyone who worked with or around him. When he climbed down into the dark mine on a cool summer's day in 1792, he knew just about nothing about the sorts and conditions below. Nothing except that there was definitely coal in these hills, and the miners who clawed it out of the ground knew only too well how it was organized and how to make some kind of sense of the chaotic state in which it existed. Several shafts made up the Mearns colliery, and Smith went down every one of them, clambering down slippery ladders and ropes, or being taken down with the chain of one of the dredgers that was powered by a Newcomen steam engine. He would write that he looked closely at the walls of the shaft and noticed the succession of layers of rocks as they slipped past his eyes. At first he was rather puzzled. "The stratification of the stones struck me as something very uncommon," he was to write a short while later. "Until I learned the technical terms of the strata and made a subterranean journey or two, I couldn't conceive a clear idea of what seems so familiar to the colliers. But when these difficulties were surmounted, an intelligent bailiff accompanied me, I was much pleased with my peregrinations below, and soon learned enough of the order of strata to describe on a plan the manner of working the coal in the lands I was then surveying." His paper plan, the first he is known to have written, and now preserved in the great Gothic Cathedral Museum in Oxford, is merely a scrap titled "Original Sketch and Observations of My First Subterranean Survey of Mearns Colliery in the Parish of High Littleton." It records, without comment, what he saw of the technology that was employed to bring the coal up from below. Horses that were harnessed to a windlass lifted the coal from the 3-bushel carts on a tramway that had wound up the second gug, an underground incline, drawn along here to the bottom of the first by a man down on his hands and feet, bare, with a cord round his waist, to which is fastened a chain that comes between his legs and hooks to the forepart of the cart. Then he went down into the pit and noted exactly what he saw. First, there was the grass and gravel of the surface, which blended seamlessly into topsoil 8 or 10 inches thick. Next came a more solid rock, at first broken into small chunks, then progressively more solid and generally red in colour, though with layers that were strangely green. It was, so far as he could make out, an earthy limestone, a marlstone, interspersed with shales, the marlstone being very red, the shales having a green tint. Overall, though, it was red and earthy, and similar, so far as he could see, to other red marls, other red earths that he had seen around Bath on his walk there from Oxfordshire. Then he noticed something very important. These marls, he wrote, were not laid down horizontally, but seemed to slope very gradually away to the east. They had a dip, an angle from the horizontal, that seemed to Smith to be about 3 degrees. They also had a strike, which is the compass direction of the line drawn where the dip intersects with the horizontal, and which in this case was aligned about 95 degrees from due north. The marl beds were sloping, in other words, in the general direction of London, and if their strike continued on the same general heading, in the direction also of Europe. Whether they continued to slope away in this direction and at this rate, and whether the marls were thus eventually buried deep below the capital or beneath the hills of France, Smith could neither tell nor imagine. But what was obvious to Smith is that they pointed in that general direction, and that they did so on a very gentle downgrade. The chain rope was clattering him slowly downward, and towards an important moment. For as he continued to gaze at the slowly passing walls, so everything around him on the sides of the mine shaft abruptly changed. Within a matter of inches, the nature of the rocks, their look and feel and colour and hardness, was all altered. Where there had been these limey, shaly, reddish-greenish, marly limestone rocks above, now instead, on the sides of the shaft, was a facies of thick, sandy, greyish-brown rocks that appeared wholly and profoundly different. Moreover, if he looked closely at the gradation between one type and the other, Smith could see that this change did not even occur within a matter of inches. It was much less, so much less that in fact there was a verifiable point at which the change occurred, a line above which was one rock, the red marl, and below which another, the grey sandstone, without any gradation between them that was worthy of the name. And it wasn't just the nature of the rocks, their lithology. Just as noticeably, the attitudes of these new rocks had changed too. Where the red marls had sloped neatly at a gentle angle, all pointing in one direction, these new grey-brown sandstones, ugly and rather unappealingly harsh rocks as they appeared to Smith in his guttering candlelight, they appeared to plunge deeply downwards. Their bedding planes, the cracks that separated one bed of sandstones from another, were steeply inclined, and in places they were very evidently folded, and in places so folded that they had been shattered and broken up by dozens of small dislocations, as though the bands of rock had once been contorted by a giant vice, all twisted, flattened and cracked, and then released and left to lie tumbled and in disarray. It was all so very strange. Back up at the top of the shaft, near the lip, had been these beguiling, neatly laid-out sheets of almost horizontal strata, with just their faint slope in the vague direction of London. Now, below them, the rocks were contorted and thrust in all manner of different directions, most of them dipping down towards the centre of the earth. As mentioned earlier, modern structural geologists, using radiometric dating techniques, taking deep drill cores and performing seismic examinations, have recently established that Somerset's coal measures were folded and twisted by the great Variscan mountain building period that occurred 290 million years ago, when the African and European tectonic plates collided. But none of this was known or even vaguely conceived by Smith or by any geologist then alive. So Smith could only stare at the junction between the rocks and wonder, why? How? How could one possibly make sense of such a bizarre arrangement? By chance, this was exactly the time when the stripling science of geology was indeed trying to make sense of such structural oddities. James Hutton, the gently born Scots doctor who was one of the leading philosophers of his age, was at the time of Smith's work just 3 years away from publishing his seminally important three-volume book, The Theory of the Earth, which sought to explain countless facts about the Earth, including precisely how such an internal discordance among strata, a so-called unconformity, had first come about. It was a very similar unconformity, in fact, that had first set Hutton thinking. He had seen another arrangement of rocks, much like those that Smith was seeing at High Littleton, in a rocky cliff on the North Sea coast of Scotland, at a now hallowed site called Sycar Point in Berwickshire. There, thick layers of the old red sandstone of Devonian times were, and still are, of course, though much chipped these days by the geological hammers of 10,000 students, lying flat on top of steeply inclined hard grey sandstones of the Silurian period. Hutton suggested that both of these sets of rocks must have been laid down by deposition from a sea, and that the grey sandstones, after being laid down, had been lifted up and out of the sea by great and mysterious crustal processes, had been subjected to all manner of contortion and twisting and deformation, then eroded so that the top of all these twisted rocks was cut off and smoothed and flattened, and finally submerged again by the sea in Devonian times to allow red sandstones, what would eventually be called the old red sandstone, to be laid down on top. And the important ideas that Hutton grasped from pondering this, and which he declared in the final volume of the great book, were these. First, that the processes of formation of rocks are the same processes, creation, erosion, deposition, change and erosion, that we see today, whether in a stream bed, by the sea, or on the flanks of a volcano. Second, that the earth works today more or less as it always has. And third, that these processes, tiny and unimportant though they may seem in the short term, take place over unimaginably long periods of time, over an uncountably large number of years, so that anything that is observable in the rocks around us today can be imagined as having happened as a result of normal, everyday occurrences taking place over eons of geological time. The present, said Hutton most memorably, is the key to the past. "If one could imagine this," wrote Hutton, and he wrote these words at almost the same time as Smith was clambering down into the Somerset mines, "then one could think of the earth as having no vestige of a beginning and no prospect of an end," as he wrote. It was a staggering thought, quite appalling to some, but it was the kind of thought that was to permeate the world of geology into which Smith, the surveyor, was just now making his entrance.